Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me on today's show where I welcome Catherine Roach. And Catherine has 25 years of grant-funded research experience on gender, sexuality, and American pop culture. She's a two-time Fulbright awardee with a PhD from Harvard and publications in both fiction and nonfiction. And she's been an invited visiting professor in Canada, Australia, and Europe. And today, her and I talk about the theme of her latest book, Good Sex, Transforming America Through the New Gender and Sexual Revolution. We talk about what makes good sex, what sex is worth having. We talk about how to navigate sex with your kids and talking about sex, making sure that we're not creating shame around sex, how to think back on our own childhood and how that frames how we think about sex today. And of course, if we're able to think about sex more objectively and realize all of the things that shape how we think about it, you know, obviously pop culture, social media, how we are raised, a lot of times we can create a more healthy relationship with it and then have better sex in our partnerships. So I really enjoyed today's conversation with Catherine. I know you guys will too. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Enjoy today's show. Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
I'm delighted to be here, Chase. Thanks for the invitation.
So in your bio, I told our listeners about your history in research and your latest book. So I thought a good place for us to start would be having you tell our listeners what motivated you to write this book, why you like talking about society and sex, and then we'll get into some of the details from the book.
Yeah, sure. I was motivated for this book more than any of the other books that I've written in the past, entirely by my students. So I'm a professor of gender, sexuality, pop culture studies, teach undergraduates at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. And for years, I taught a small seminar of about 15 or 16 students on those topics. And the students would bring me so many stories about what it's like to be a young person growing up in America now, trying to figure out relationships, trying to figure out issues of gender and sexual identity, often having to navigate issues of shame and trauma, bullying around the body, around sexual assault or sexual harassment, sexual bullying in various forms. And I just felt I needed to scale up the small seminar I was doing to something bigger in order to impact, have a wider impact on a campus conversation about gender and sexual diversity and sexual health. So many young people in America have really poor experiences of sex education growing up, going through their school. So they come to college not knowing much, having porn as sort of their default sex ed in many cases. So I created this large lecture class, and I've been teaching it every term now at the university. Hundreds of students have passed through the course at this point. And it became not just a learning space, a curricular space for thinking about issues of healthy, intimate relationship, but it became sort of a lab space for me to develop this new book project. So my current book, Good Sex, Transforming America Through the New Gender and Sexual Revolution, is full of comments from the students themselves. So it's a very collaborative, interactive book in that way. It's full of these pull quotes and sidebars that share student responses from the course, but their experience trying to figure out intimate relationships and thinking about gender and sexual diversity, sexual justice in America today. So I was really inspired by the students about a sense of need on the one hand, but also a sense of hope and resilience on the other hand. And that's how the book came about.
So I thought maybe an interesting place to start would be what the students and maybe yourself and the larger conversation, what makes good sex? What are they saying? I know that's a big thing, but
That's a big question. It's a great question. So that's very much what the book is about. And I deliberately titled the book Good Sex. It's a bit of a play on the word, meant to be sort of eye-catching, but also a play on the word, because good is this very grand old word, ancient word, deep roots in the English language, and it carries these dual meanings of both ethical and pleasurable. So I call the book Good Sex, and I'm in this course and with my students, we're interrogating what this means to think about positive sexuality in the 21st century in these two dimensions of both ethical and pleasurable. So how these two aspects, these two definitions of good intertwine in positive sexuality. So I would say good sex is sex that is good, as in ethical, morally commendable on the one hand, and then also good as in pleasurable on the other hand. So as to the ethical, good sex is always consensual, fully adult consensual sex. It does no harm. It impacts people's lives in positive ways. And then as to the pleasurable, good sex is erotic. It's stimulating. It's sensual. It satisfies desire, right? It leads to physical, emotional, social involvement for all, enjoyment for all partners involved. So in both senses, good sex does good and it feels good. And I think it's very important that those two elements be kept in mind and that seen as feeding one another, interacting together. So that's the definition of good sex, of a positive sexuality or sex positivity that I'm building here in this book.
Yeah. So there's so much that goes into how an individual thinks about sex, like how we're raised, culture, our friends, porn now, social media. And I think a lot of times it gets confusing, you know, like shame arises. So how do you talk about that? I think, raising awareness of just how all these things impact us. But I just kind of wonder, like for myself, like if I was raised, I don't want to say isolated because, in such a way that I was in a vacuum, you know, and I just had like my evolutionary animalistic feelings about sex without the puritanism and the media to dilute it, like how I would look at it, you know, if that makes sense, because I look at it and it's confusing sometimes. Sometimes I have shame around it. Sometimes I judge maybe around it, a partner for their sexual history, even not like overtly, but like it almost like on a subconscious level. So I'm saying a lot here, but how do you think about that in terms of like evolutionarily what maybe good sex is and then how that manifests when culture and all these other things are layered on top, how we can think about that in a healthy way?
Yeah, well, there's lots there in what you just said, Chase. Yes, lots of really important points. Sexuality certainly has this, there's this built-in biological evolutionary aspect to it. It's how the species reproduces, clearly. There's a built-in drive, biological imperative that leads us to connect together and produce babies, and the species continues that way. So there is that sort of biological substratum or bedrock to sexuality. But then obviously it's a lot more, as you were just describing. So it's how we connect in some of the most intimate ways with other people. I often think of sexuality as one of the most messy, high-stakes aspects of being human. Right. It's where we get naked with another person. So there's a physical vulnerability, but then there's also an emotional vulnerability. We open ourselves up to be with another person, or to be emotionally naked as well as physically naked when you let somebody into your life, let them into your heart. So that it's a high stakes, high risk activity. You're right. So it can lead to heartbreak. It can lead to emotional and financial and just logistical chaos when things go wrong. But then there's also this promise, this hope of love in some cases. We live in this culture that has a very strong storyline about find your one true love and live happily ever after. And that's there's power to that love narrative, but it's also a script that can be that can put a huge amount of pressure on people to try to live up to that, and then a lot of shame when it feels like it's not quite working out, or what am I doing wrong in my relationship? So you're right, all of that goes into sexuality and sexual encounters, this aspect of the biology and the cultural scripts that we're inculcated into growing up with, like princess Disney movies, and examples we get from family, from media, from social media, from the culture around us. So it's a lot to figure out. Absolutely. There's a trial and error element to it. As I mentioned, I think American education often does a pretty poor job of providing high quality, comprehensive sex education in school systems to help kids figure out these issues as they're going through puberty and dealing with hormonal surges and trying to figure out how to have healthy intimate relationship. And parents can obviously do a lot to sort of pick up that slack, but we, as parents, we often carry that same sort of shame that you were talking about, or an ignorance or a confusion ourselves, a sense of anxiety. How do you talk about sexuality? And so parents often aren't great teachers for their kids, resources for their kids. So it is a high stakes, very important area to think about, to try to work through. I think your podcast is one place that is trying to provide resources.
Well, let's dive into it a little bit, because there's obviously lots to talk about, different approaches, but you mentioned talking to kids. And I think even if someone listening doesn't have kids, I think it's valuable in the way to maybe reframe the way we think about sexuality as an adult. So I have a 7-year-old daughter, Sarah, and I have a daughter, Stella, and I want her to have everything. You know, I want her to... to just be a happy, healthy adult one day and kid right now. But as it relates to sexuality, that's more of a thing down the road. But I think it does start now, in like the sense of bodies and what we call our genitals. You know, even the word private parts insinuates that this is something, I don't know, maybe like there is this idea that it's not for everyone, but also I don't want there to be shame around your quote private parts. So Sarah and I make sure we call the anatomy by its like biological, like daddy has a penis, mommy has a vagina, not, you know, not a pee-pee. And I think that came from reading about it, of like not having stigma around it, that these are just things that we have. And yeah, one day I'm going to teach you what they're used for and the birds and the bees, but actually not having the birds and the bees conversation, but having like a real conversation of how babies are made, and not, I guess, creating like this mysticism around it that we can't talk about it, like that it's not appropriate for them, right? Because it is, you know, obviously there's like stages. So what are some ways that we could talk to a kid about sexuality, but also in the framework of thinking about it for ourselves?
Yeah. I think sounds like you and Sarah are great parents. You're doing exactly what you should with your daughter. Yeah. I think that's wonderful to be thinking through these issues, how to be a good parent to kids, how to help develop a sense of a healthy, intimate relationship and sexuality early on. So there's a responsibility for parents, there's a responsibility in the schools to do the same as well. So I think for young kids in particular, there's some really important messages. In sex education, they talk about how it can be scaffolded. So messages that are appropriate, you know, age-appropriate scaffolding. So you talk to little kids, primary school kids, in a different way, obviously, than you would middle school kids, high school kids, college kids. But there's some very important lessons, as you were just saying, that are absolutely appropriate for young kids, even 7-year-olds, primary school kids. I'd say there's three that I would highlight as very important at that age. One, like you were just talking about, is to name the parts of the body. That's really important, and to do it in a shame-free way. So like you're saying, otherwise there's a sense of stigma, that there's something dirty, nasty, wrong about your genitals. If you can't name them, like we teach kids, you know, eyes, ears, mouth, and nose, these little, here's your shoulders, here's your elbows. We teach them the parts of their body. And then if you suddenly go blank in your private parts, it instills a sense of shame. And it also means they don't have the words to talk about their own body and to be able to protect themselves against issues of sexual harassment or sexual abuse, child sexual abuse. They need to be able to know that they have parts of their body that are theirs, that are private and that others shouldn't touch. And they need the words to talk about that. So to just have a shame-free knowledge of their body, that's really important. To have this sense of the privacy of their body, their personal bodily autonomy, to be able to protect themselves, to stand up for themselves, and be their own first line of defense against any sort of inappropriate touch. That's really important. It relates to wider issues of consent. So in the age of Me Too, you know, consent is foundational to everything. And these are lessons that kids could be taught. That they should not be touched in the private parts of their body and in their genitalia, but also that they have the right, like, you know, there's that sort of that trope about the, I don't know, the grandma or the uncle coming in for the big hug, just grabbing the little kid up and, oh, you're so cute, and grabbing their cheeks and kissing them. And, you know, that's often kids don't like that, and they have the right to say no. So not all kids are huggers or snugglers. And they have the right to set their own boundaries. That's an important lesson that kids deserve to learn early on. And then I think the third lesson that's really appropriate for kids around sexuality is to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion really early on. So some kids have a mommy and a daddy, and some kids have two daddies, or some kids have two mommies, and you know, families come in all sorts of forms. Some kids have a non-gender binary parent, or they're looked after by grandparents or foster caregivers. You know, families come in all sorts of forms. And what's important is that there's love and support in the family, not that it matches up to some sort of, you know, patriarchal notion of the mom in the kitchen and the dad out at work, you know, so that there's diversity underlined and supported and celebrated from the get-go in kids' minds. So I think these lessons start early, and then they get reinforced and they become more nuanced and spelled out as kids grow up. And hopefully they're hearing these lessons at home, they're hearing them at school, they're hearing them in sort of the cultural storylines and social media and the visual culture of movies, film, etc. TV, Peppa the Pig, you know, Peppa the Pig, this little kid's animated cartoon. They had just this past term, they had their first storyline about two moms, a lesbian couple raising, I don't know the story, that, like, I guess it's about raising piglets. I don't follow Peppa the Pig, but having their first diverse story around gender, sexual diversity. So we're hearing this more throughout the culture. And these, I think, are great developments.
Before we continue on, we're going to take a short break to tell you about our sponsors. When you work full time, have kids, and run a podcast, it's hard to make time for a multiple step skincare protocol. That's why I'm excited to tell you about today's sponsor, OneSkin. Their products make it easy to keep your skin healthy while looking and feeling your best. Let me repeat it. They make it easy. No complicated routine, just simple, scientifically validated solutions. If you're looking for skincare products that are simple and effective, for a limited time, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your first OneSkin purchase when using the code IDO when you check out at oneskin.co. I've been using OneSkin's body lotion for about a month, and I've already seen noticeable improvements with small wrinkles and textures on my skin, specifically on the back of my neck and the back of my hands, two places where I get a lot of sun. Plus, my skin looks and feels healthier all around. It's all thanks to OneSkin's revolutionary OS-01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to deactivate aging cells responsible for lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. Unlike traditional skincare products that only mask symptoms, OneSkin pioneered a new approach, integrating tissue engineering and cutting-edge science to enhance skin biology for lasting resilience against aging. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using the code IDO at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with the code IDO. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support your show and tell them we sent you. Women's health, especially PMS and perimenopause, has been one of those chronically neglected areas when it comes to research and solutions. Thankfully, we have today's sponsor, Happy Mammoth. Our sponsor, Happy Mammoth, saw that there were no effective nature-inspired solutions to these issues, so they made one. Estrocontrol. Relationship advice listeners can now get 15% off your entire order on happymammoth.com with our promo code IDO at checkout. Estrocontrol contains science-backed herbal extracts that help support hormonal health. The way Estrocontrol eases PMS is pretty interesting. The ingredients help support the liver, and that is where all of our hormones get processed, especially estrogen. So when estrogen isn't processed well in the liver, some women may start having PMS symptoms, like spots on the skin, cravings, and feeling low all of a sudden. Estrocontrol was created to help women feel like themselves throughout the whole month. Estrocontrol is made especially for women who are premenopausal. It's really great for perimenopause when hormones start to fluctuate and PMS becomes really rough. I personally struggle from PMS firsthand, from super discomfort to just not feeling like myself. PMS has put me through the ringer time and time again, and I know it's not just me. I've seen my relationship suffer in those times when PMS takes over. Estrocontrol works to relieve many of those consuming PMS symptoms, helping us regain control. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with a promo code IDO at checkout. That's happymammoth, MAMMOTH.com, and use the promo code IDO for 15% off your first order.
Here's one for you that might answer some more questions. What age or how should I think about Stella seeing me naked? Because that's something that I've been thinking about. I'm naked around her and it's not like a thing, you know, like I'll take a shower. Sometimes I shower with her. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not a pediatrician. I'm not a child psychologist. So I think there's no one answer. I think right. There's tons of ways for parents and kids to have a happy, supportive, healthy family home life. I think it's important not to stigmatize the naked body, that there shouldn't be shame or fear or anxiety around the body. There's part of, I think, the sort of moment that we're in of new gender and sexual revolution is a real emphasis on body positivity and body acceptance. We're seeing that with like plus size models or underwear companies using disabled models or real people to advertise, model their products. So there's less, you know, there's more about there's less fat shaming and sort of more discourse about that. So all of that is about celebrating the body, saying it's perfectly normal, natural. We all have a body. Bodies come in different shapes and sizes. There's nothing shameful about the body in and of itself. Privacy is an important concept. One doesn't walk around naked in public unless one is in a nudist colony and everybody's agreed, so that there's issues of consent there. But I think it's perfectly possible to have happy, healthy nudity in the home. Like sometimes it just happens. You know, you're bathing kids and you're bathing yourself, or you're changing and the child walks in the room where you're changing. I think it's better to be normal and natural about that than to like suddenly grab clothes or a robe and try to immediately cover up like there's something horrific about the naked body. So I think parents and kids, families work these issues out for themselves. I suspect kids have, as they grow up, they have different attitudes towards that themselves, preferences that they might want to express about like when they get old enough to bathe themselves and when they want privacy in the bathroom. And I think, you know, in healthy families, you can work these issues out with just sort of strong communication skills, open discussion.
Yeah. And sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot as a child psychologist, but I think that everything you said is valuable because I think it can help us think about when we were children. And I can imagine, you know, if you did have a father who like you walked in when you were seven and he covered up and was like, no, like get out. And no, you can't see this. And then maybe was
that
like,
could be sort of traumatic, right?
Yeah, you think, exactly.
The naked body is shameful.
Right.
This is a horror. Yeah.
Yeah. Make sure you knock next time. And I'm sure that's happened. And I'm not to criticize those parents. Everyone's doing the best they can, but it's interesting when we start to, you know, as a parent, but then reflecting back on our own childhood, which is where a lot of these, our views on sexuality came from, and being like, oh, that's why I have so much shame around my body, because there was all this taboo around it in the house. And that kind of brings us back to talking to our audience. Obviously, people in our audience are parents, but just thinking about how all these things influence our views on sexuality. And as I said, trying to frame it, like if I was in a vacuum, how I would think about it. And it helps me be, I guess, less judgmental towards myself and towards others. And there's levels to it. I'm not going around telling anyone what to do with their body. But I have noticed in myself that when I have had partners and they have much different approaches to sexuality and how they view it. Like it could be just number of partners, how, you know, they approach sexuality as a very physical act, and emotionally it doesn't mean much to them. And that's interesting because for me, it's both. It's very physical and I'm very emotionally engaged and there's a lot of emotion around it. And so it's been interesting and valuable for me to have these partners that have different approaches, because it's boring if everyone's the same, and because it's like, oh, wow, like that's so different than the way I approach it and the way I feel. And I think in the context of relationships, that's why it's so important to have these conversations with your partner, to understand for ourselves, but then to share with our partner so we can see where each of us is coming from, have more empathy, and then ultimately connect better in emotionally and sexually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot there in what you were just saying, Chase. It's very important, very powerful. So we all carry, I use the term scripts. We carry these scripts, these narratives in our head that you learn about growing up, and then you sort of inculcate, you make them your own. And in some cases, they can be really limiting. So scripts about gender and sexuality, traditional notions of masculinity and femininity, how we're supposed to live out, embody our gender, and then live out our sexuality, and they can inhibit people from, they can block people from having, I think, healthy, intimate lives and connection with each other's. I've been thinking a lot about recently the scripts about masculinity that guys grow up with, little boys are taught, and how those are changing nowadays. So we live in, I think, a really interesting time in that regard. So there's these traditional notions of masculinity. They call it the man box sometimes. And little boys are, you know, told messages like big boys don't cry and you're supposed to be tough and grow up, be a man, don't be a pussy, don't be a wussy. A lot of shaming and bullying around gender. And those traditional gender messages include scripts about sexuality. So traditionally, you had to be heterosexual, you had to be a sexual player, you had to be dominant, in control in the bedroom, masterful, like a great lover who the big erection that you can hold forever, right, to please your woman, and all of these scripts about gender and sexuality. And so this man box, traditional masculinity, in a way, in a lot of ways, it's what there's toxic elements to it, right? So we've been talking more about toxic masculinity in the culture recently, and how it's bad. It can be bad in relationships, but it can be really toxic for a guy himself, that it involves shutting down emotions. So traditionally, in toxic masculinity, you can be angry. Anger is an allowable emotion, but that tenderness, that emotional expressiveness that you were talking about, that connecting emotionally, being vulnerable and looking to develop an emotional connection, is often not part of a traditional valued type of dominant masculinity. So in the new, we're talking more about the new masculinity, new inclusive masculinities. So in the plural, the sense that there's more than one way to be a good man. I think that's a really interesting discourse that I'm hearing more and more about, and that my students, guy students, are talking about. The sense, the American Psychological Association came out with a report just in, 2018, about the cost to boys themselves of these restrictive man box rules, and how it would be better for boys, better for men, better for women, better for everyone, the culture as a whole, if we open up the man box and have a wider array of emotional expression allowed to boys. And it would impact intimate lives. It would impact sexuality. It would, and we're starting to see this, I think, in depictions of masculinity and social media, TikTok, young people in particular, non-gender binary thing, even unisex clothing is another way where we're starting to see this. So just more openness, I think, ends up being better for everyone. I think that's a very interesting development that we're tracing these days.
Yeah, there's a lot of positivity in what seems like an understanding of how our history has clouded how we think about sexuality, and with a lot of negativity, with a lot of shame. So just that awareness is super valuable. I want to ask you, one of the things that I said in the beginning that you address in the book is what sex is worth having, because I think there's lots of scripts around that, and I certainly have mine. So I'm curious what that conversation looks like.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I was talking about sex positivity or positive sexuality, and one misunderstanding of that term is that it's an encouragement or an emphasis that more people need to be having more sex all the time, that in order to be, I don't know, cool or with it in the 21st century, you got to be out there having hot, wild sex. And that's not what sex positivity is about at all. So that phrase that you were using, what sex is worth having, or what intimate relationships are worth having, is really key. So from a point of view of positive sexuality, we would be against slut shaming, for instance. So taking away the double standards that guys can have multiple partners, but women can't. So trying to undo slut shaming, but also undo virgin shaming, prude shaming. So there can be pressure. My students talk about this in campus hookup culture, for example, pressure to be sexually active before you're really ready to do so, or in situations where you're not really interested in doing so. And that is not a positive development. That's not an example of sex positivity. That would be sex negativity, right? Nobody should ever be pushed or pressured into sexual relationships or activity, like by this cultural sense that the hookup is where it's at, or that this is what you have to do nowadays to be out there, to be having fun. So from a sex positive perspective, we would be giving people the information, the cultural space, the support to think through their own values and their desires, to be able to connect with their desires in a shame-free way, and to be able to have the communication skills, the self-advocacy skills, sense of cultural support, to have conversation with others, to develop relationship with others, to be able to figure out what relationships are worth having, what sexual activity is worth having, that's consonant with your desires, that is responsive to full, informed adult consent, talking through in a deep way what consent means in any given circumstance. So it's not always about more sex at all. In thinking about gender and sexual diversity, asexuality is another term that is becoming more current in the culture. So I got lots of asexual students these days, students who are on the ace spectrum, for whom sexuality is not a big deal. It's not a driving force in their life at all. They may still be interested in romantic relationships, in intimate emotional relationships of various sorts, but not sexual ones. And that's perfectly consonant with a notion of sex positivity also. So yeah, asking all sorts of questions about when and where sex is the right decision for you.
Before we continue on, we're going to take a short break to tell you about our sponsors. After a decade of hosting this podcast and talking to hundreds of experts, we know that money is one of the biggest stressors in relationships. Now, while worrying about money and anxiously awaiting payday doesn't help, Earnin actually does by putting the money you earn in your hands today. Our sponsor, Earnin, is an app that gives you access to your pay-as-you-work up to $100 a day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an additional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. Many couples end up fighting about finances, especially when surprise costs arise. Earnin allows you to seamlessly deal with the unexpected trip to the vet or that splurge on date night without the added stress, letting you both focus on what really matters. Earnin is helping millions of Americans feel self-sufficient and to worry and fight less about money. All of this without debt traps, mandatory fees, or credit checks. Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in relationship advice under podcast when you sign up. It really helps the show. That's relationship advice under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Hey, Love Tribe, I have just a few questions for you. I want to know why you are here listening to the podcast. Are you here because you want to stop bickering with your partner and you want to feel truly heard? Or are you looking for ways to reignite your sex life? Or do you want to feel more emotionally connected with your partner? Or do you just long for those fun, giggly moments of connection that you used to have at the beginning of your relationship? Well, over the last decade of hosting this podcast, those were the main reasons people tuned into the show. And we get it. We've been there. So we created our course, Spark My Relationship, because we wanted to put those tools to unlocking a fulfilling relationship right in your hands. We're offering $100 off our course, Spark My Relationship, which is a self-paced course designed to help you create more passion, improve your communication, and build a stronger, more intimate connection with your partner and have an amazing time doing it. We've collaborated with over 15 therapists and psychologists to bring you the strategies that marriage therapists teach their clients. So to unlock this special offer of our course, our listeners can visit sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock to get $100 off. That's sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock.
I'm thinking about all this individually and as a father, and I think that's really valuable to think about that there is no right or wrong way of saying what sex is worth having. What sex is worth having is whatever you decide. And what I hear you saying is, but our decisions can be clouded by pressure, by culture, by all these things. So really trying to unpack that and then checking in with yourself and going, you know what? I don't really want to have sex with this particular person or a person right now, but I feel pressure because all my friends are having sex. And, you know, especially as a guy, and I remember feeling that around losing my virginity. You know, I was 18 when I did, and I wouldn't change anything, but it very much was not like how I would want to do it again, you know, or how I would want Stella to do it. It was more like, let me get this over with, because it was like the pressure of I'm 18. I should have had sex by now. My friends are having sex, and we all do the best we can. But I think as I think about this in the context of Stella, my 7-year-old, and when she's getting closer to puberty, of teaching her to really check in with herself and to really go, you know, what is it that I want? And am I doing this out of what reasons do I feel the need to? And obviously in consent and all these things that will be really important for her to understand. But I think even as an adult, even as a 37-year-old who is dating myself, I've been thinking about this a lot. It's like, why am I trying to be in a relationship? What does that mean to me? What am I trying to get validation from sex? All of these things are important things to ask ourselves, whether we're single, whether we're teaching our children, or if we've been married for 30 years, there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are all great points. And in relation to the story you were telling about yourself as an 18-year-old and your hopes for your daughter who's 7 now. Yeah, I hear those same things, the same anxieties from my students. Guys definitely can get pressured into sex they don't want, they're not ready for. It's a lot of shaming. The virgin shaming that you were talking about, or just the, you know, still narratives around masculinity, you know, aren't you man enough? Can't you get it up? Don't you think I'm pretty? So guys' consent can get violated in all of those ways, not, you know, so much the sort of the physical violation of consent, a forcible rape that was sort of our stereotype of rape, but guys can get pressured, emotionally manipulated and coerced into sex out of a shaming around their gender. So that's one way that we need to support boys more, young men, as they're coming into a sense of their sexual identity. And then for girls, the way it often plays out is that girls are still taught that their job is to look sexy and not so much allow the space to explore their own sexual desire. So these are narratives that are also changing, gender scripts around femininity in the culture that have, you know, the women's movement and its various waves feminism has certainly changed these scripts about what women can do and what their role in society is. But there's still this lingering emphasis that a woman is supposed to look good, and that part of the role she plays in the culture and in heterosexual relationships is to satisfy male desire. She's there to, you know, to be looked at, to look good, to embody a certain groomed vision of feminine attractiveness, and to satisfy male desire. So in hookup culture, in particular on college campuses, I hear this all the time from my students. There's this orgasm gap. The traditional heterosexual hookup is about the male orgasm and not the female orgasm. It's about a guy having his pleasure attended to, having his desire met, and a woman not. She's there to satisfy his desire. And even a woman, like they, girls have lower rates of masturbation than boys. There's less cultural encouragement to explore your body, to get to know how your body works, to figure out how your pleasure works, how your body works for pleasure, what feels good for you. And less support to be able to express that to a partner, say, hey, this feels good to me. How about we try this? So the girls need to be supported in connecting with their desire in a shame-free way. And that's not easy. That's not easy work at all. that involves changing gender scripts and as well as scripts about sexuality in the culture. The orgasm gap does close. Research shows as couples get to know each other better, this heterosexual orgasm gap shrinks. And interestingly, it doesn't seem to exist in same-sex hookups. So there's a lesson there as well.
So much to talk about. And Catherine, I think today we covered a lot. I didn't anticipate on getting into to parenting stuff, but it's all kind of connected and I think super valuable to think about. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on and have this discussion. Before we wrap up, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online, where they can find the book? And then if there's anything we skipped over or something you want to emphasize, and then we'll say goodbye.
Yes, well, thanks for having me on, Chase. It's been a very interesting conversation. I think these connections to parenting are really important because we as adults, we carry these ideas about gender and sexuality from our experiences growing up as children and as teens in both family situations and in the culture. I think it's really important to reflect back on that and to, as adults and teachers and parents, to try to do our best possible job with the young people in our charge. I have a website at my new college departmental space at the University of Alabama. So you can find me on my website there through New College at the University of Alabama. My new book is out just this fall from Indiana University Press, Good Sex, Transforming America Through the New Gender and Sexual Revolution. And your listeners can buy it through Amazon or through their, order it through a local bookstore. It's available at the Indiana University Press website as well.
Excellent.
I do a weekly newsletter for my students that other people interested are able to subscribe to as well. And there's a link to the newsletter on my website at the University of Alabama. So I'd be happy to connect with people that way too.
We will have those links in our show notes and on our website, idopodcast.com. Thanks again for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you, Chase. Have a good day.
Thank you guys so much for tuning into today's episode. As always, all the links to the guest as well as any of their recommendations will be in the show notes page. You can find the link to that in the episode description or by going to idopodcast.com. Click on the podcast tab up at the top and you will have access to all the episodes that we've ever done. There are over 300 of them. And while you're on our website, if you haven't checked out our free 14-day Happy Couple Challenge, we really hope you do. It's a free email challenge that we send to you. It's 14 days of fun, easy, doable challenges to help strengthen and improve your relationship. And if you're looking for something that provides a little more help with working on your relationship, whether it's improving intimacy or communication with your partner, or just bringing the spark back, we would love for you guys to check out our online course, Spark My Relationship. We're offering $100 off to all of our listeners if you go to sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. We've worked with over 15 psychologists and therapists to create the real life tools and strategies that they are teaching their clients. So we wanted to give them to you. It's a self-paced online course that can be done in as little as a month or up to 3 months. You can really decide how much or how little you want to do with your partner, or maybe just yourself. So we hope you guys check that out. It's sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. Have a great day.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.